Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ. Bill, tell us about you. I think people sometimes want us to set things up. Who are you and why are you here?
Bill Scher, senior writer at the Campaign for America's Future, at ourfuture.org, columnist for theweek.com, and longtime blogger, one of the original bloggers, at liberaloasis.com.
And I'm Matt Lewis, and I am a senior contributor at the Daily Caller and also a columnist at The Week. Bill, it has been a week that has been dominated by news in Syria, and we could talk about that, but you had some interesting ideas of how we can advance this conversation or have a little, hate to say have fun with it, it's so serious, but how we can discuss it in a way that won't be rehashing what every other blogging head show is talking about this week.
Well, if correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I am someone who was adamantly against the Iraq war, and I would call myself supportive of a strike in Syria. I wouldn't call myself a cheerleader, but if I was in Congress, I would vote yes to authorize Obama for a strike. I think I lean that way, and I believe you were for the Iraq war, but are a lean against a strike in Syria. Is that a fair characterization?
So when the Iraq war happened, I wasn't a commentator or a writer or a pundit. So I really never took a position on it, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I suppose I would have probably been in favor of it just because I'm a conservative and, you know, but it wasn't something that I thought about in the same way that I think about it today. So I put an asterisk there. But I do have a record of sort of being for and against things. I was against allowing Mubarak to be toppled. I felt that it was in America's best interest to support Mubarak. I was for a no-fly zone in Libya. And I'm not on the fence. I'm absolutely opposed to Syrian intervention at this point. So that I do have a track record, a more recent track record post-Iraq, and that's kind of where I stand.
So are you on a straight line? You have the same foreign policy view generally that you had 10 years ago, and just that Syria does not measure up to your reasoning. I grant you that your reasoning in Iraq was kind of, you know, more superficial because you weren't a professional commentator at that point. But whether there's a standard for Iraq and Libya that is not met in Syria, or is there a shift in your view that is either crass politics, you hate Obama, I don't want to be on the same side as him, or you've seen what has happened with these past interventions, and so your views have changed?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that even assuming that America was ready and prepared to topple Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. All these guys are bad guys. So let's start with that. We're better off that he's dead. Hussein was a bad guy, and he had used chemical weapons against his own people in the past. And it turned out that America didn't just need to topple him, but they didn't just need regime change, but we ended up having to do this nation building and this counterinsurgency plan. And it took, you know, a decade and a ton of treasure and just spirit, life, human life. Families were destroyed. I mean, all sorts of things happened. And we did it. We'll see where it goes from there. But I would argue we're less equipped today to do that by virtue of having done Iraq and Afghanistan. Even if you thought, like, okay, we could sustain that sort of effort because the purpose is so important, I don't think we could do it today. I don't think there's the will to do it, let alone the resources. I try to look at it. So I do believe that America ought to be a force for good in the world. And in the case of Syria, there's just too many problems. So I do believe Assad is a bad guy. If there were moderate rebels, if I believe that there were moderate rebels who were capable of defeating him, and then potentially installing is a bad word, but having the infrastructure to create political institutions to eventually have a democracy, I would probably support some sort of, you know, no-fly zone or something, because I think you would argue that, you know, at the end of the day, the Syrian people would be better off, the world community would be better off. The problem is that doesn't happen. The people, the best trained and best motivated right now, are essentially tied to Al-Qaeda. And so you can't topple Assad. So I guess you can send some sort of a message that don't use chemical weapons. So I would say that to answer your question, Bill, if I've changed at all, it's not that I've changed in terms of my philosophy or worldview, except that I think I'm much more skeptical today of what the experts say, the so-called experts. And I'm also much, you know, during the Republican debates, I always encourage Republicans to question the sort of implications of the question, the assumptions made in the question. And I think that we should do that when we listen to hawkish commentators and advisors who say, yes, but if we don't do something, this will happen. Well, how do you know that will happen? Or it'll send a message to Iran. I'm much more skeptical of the so-called experts. I used to be much more and likely to believe the dire warnings of horrible things that I couldn't see. It was like almost a Rube Goldberg sort of situation. But these people much smarter than me and much more knowledgeable than me about foreign policy say that this chain of events will happen. And I would heed their warnings. I would say that as someone who is just a conservative, I probably was too quick to give the benefit of the doubt to people warning that if we didn't have some sort of military action, X, Y, and Z would happen. I'm much more skeptical now of the so-called experts.
So that's I just want to pinpoint that for you. So you have an evolution there as far as skepticism of expert warnings from Iraq to Syria, but there is a consistent thread there as far as supportive of American intervention to ensure foreign governments are allied with America, which seems to be a little bit different than just simply being pro-democracy. You were for keeping Mubarak, even if that meant not being for democracy. You were for no-fly zone in Libya because you were comfortable with the nature of the Libyan opposition and didn't want to be...
That's right, Bill. That's right. And in the case of Mubarak, it's actually very consistent with where I am on Syria because, Mubarak was better than Assad. Mubarak was a horrible, ruthless dictator, but he had kept stability for 30 years, and he had been, you know, nominally pro-Israel. And we sort of knew that if Mubarak went down, the street would not elect, you know, Abraham Lincoln. And I think that proved to be true. I think that one certainly proved to be true.
Well, as far as myself goes, I don't consider my view to be a change in basic outlook. Although I'm sure I'll be pilloried for, you know, supporting it when it's my guy. But I feel like, you know, this is about maintaining a foreign policy direction that I currently support with Bush. It wasn't that I was against war in all circumstances. I was against the foreign policy goals and objectives that he and his team had outlined. either directly from, you know, the White House podium or in some of the papers that have been published by team members or allies separate from the White House that made me be skeptical about what was being said from the podium. I did not like the neoconservative view. I did not like Pax Americana. I did not like the prospect of permanent military bases being imposed on an unwilling population. And I did not like the notion that we were trying to control oil supply routes militarily to screw over China. I thought all those were bad foreign policy objectives that would cause a big blowback. If Bush,
you know, it wasn't just Bush, of course. Everyone thought that Iraq had WMDs. Mm-hmm. You might have supported some sort of a limited strike or even an invasion to, try to deter and degrade his weapons-making capability, just not toppling the regime, not nation-building, and not the whole, you know, decade spent, trying to create a democracy in the desert.
I was for Hussein not having weapons of mass destruction, but I thought that would, at the time, we can achieve that without going in with a full-blown invasion. We do have a UN weapons inspections process that had been going on for a long period of time. You know, I didn't oppose it when Clinton had limited military strikes to achieve that. Yeah, I might have been a little worried that it might spiral out of control, but I wasn't out there in the streets opposing it the way I was with Bush, because I felt like this was actually about trying to contain the weapons of mass destruction stockpile, not about some other ulterior motive. That was my big concern with Bush. With Obama, I feel like this has been a very dramatic break in foreign policy, not just with Bush, but America's posture going back decades. I think the move with Mubarak is probably the most indicative of that we were willing to push out an allied dictator in the name of self-determination. We were willing to recognize the Muslim Brotherhood candidate when he won, in respect of the political process, as opposed to what Bush did with when Hamas won in Palestine, and we supported the election. Then when the outcome was we didn't like it, we then pulled our funds. That struck me as not being true to democracy, and I missed opportunity to show that perhaps democracy could change behavior of these groups. Now, unfortunately, in Egypt, there were some behavioral changes with Morsi. They didn't go sponsoring Hamas attacks in Israel from Egypt, but they were not properly sensitive to what the secular population in Egypt wanted, and unfortunately that led everything to break apart. Now things are obviously a big question mark, so I think that's an unfortunate outcome, but I don't blame Obama's decision for that. I blame the actions of Morsi, although I'm not, this is not to rationalize what the Egyptian military is doing either. That what they're doing is abhorrent. So it's a bad situation. I still hope the eggshell can be pieced back together at some point. Sorry to digress on that. My point is, I like Obama's basic direction. I think it's correct to be as consistently pro-democracy as possible, to take advantage of these opportunities. The Libya, I thought it was important that he went in, because there was an opposition that was reflective of the people as a whole and was even able to get UN backing for, which I thought was important for shoring up international institutions. And now here comes Syria, where you have a more complicated situation. As you note, the opposition is not as clean. And because Russia apparently feels burned by how Libya turned out, is not being as conciliatory as far as UN authorization is concerned. But you still have a situation where an international norm of the use of chemical weapons has been violated. It's not a stockpile question. Actually used it. And you still want broadly a Syria that has a government reflective of its people and is not one faction being dictatorial over another faction. So So I appreciate the pickle Obama's in executing his basic desires for foreign policy in that circumstance. And I feel at least that the outcome, the objective he's trying to attain, what he's saying explicitly, trying to show there's consequence for violating the Geneva Convention, I support that objective. What he says is a separate objective, separate from the military strikes, is the objective of getting Syria to force Assad out, not to replace him with another faction, but to get to some kind of power-sharing agreement that's reflective of the Syrian peoples. I support that objective. So I don't... I'm not critical of somebody who feels that a military strike won't achieve those objectives. That it'll be too limited, so Assad won't respond to it. It might cause a regional war, and therefore you won't get to any kind of hunky-dory political settlement. I'm not going to go out there and say, I know that you're wrong and I'm right, because I don't know that. But I'm comfortable with where Obama wants to go, and therefore I'm more trusting in saying if he thinks this tactic is the best way to get there, I'm not in a position to say, I know you're wrong. So that's why I would lean in favor of supporting it in hopes of achieving the objectives that Obama wants to get. That's where I am.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, we could relitigate this whole thing, the Obama... I mean, it's like just lobbing some bombs over there to send a message, mainly to protect Obama, because he said that using chemical weapons was a red line. There's no intent to topple Assad. And I don't think we should want to topple him. It just seems like an utter waste of time to do this, and one gets the sense that a lot of it is done to sort of preserve Obama's reputation as a tough guy and as someone who, you know, his sort of credibility for, you know, saying that there was a red line, which was obviously a gaffe. And then it's just weird to see the Nancy Pelosi's and the Menendez's and the Kerry's go out there and essentially parrot the same stuff that the Bushies said, and it's you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy, I'm sure, on both sides of this, but clearly, I mean, I think we, you know, probably had. I would venture to say that there was a better case that Hussein had WMDs than that Assad ordered these chemical weapon strikes. So. I don't know. It really strikes me as situational ethics here is taking place.
Well, we have two points of disagreement here. One is you have a fundamental concern that if Assad goes, that what will replace him will certainly be bad.
Arguably worse.
And
I mean, Assad's horrible. He's a dictator. He is tied with Iran and Hezbollah and Russia. And yet, he's stable and he seems to be sane, which we can't say about the people who would, you know, take over in his absence.
Right. And even if
Assad's relatives take over, never mind the toppling the regime, even if we just killed Assad, the relatives that take over would probably be worse than him.
Now, and I would acknowledge that that's possible. I mean, there's obviously elements in the Syrian opposition that would be horrible if they controlled the country. I think Obama is well aware of that fact. If he was not aware of that fact, he would just be outright arming them, you know, to the hilt and being clearly on one side of the war and trying to force Assad and force Assad out that way. And he's not doing that. He's trying to make a different... He's trying to thread the needle a little bit and see, is there a way that we can force an untenable stalemate that forces all parties back to the table? You get to a power sharing agreement that is not going to empower the
okay,
Al-Qaeda.
So okay, I just want to stop you there. You're saying that these strikes are meant to change the trajectory of the war. That these are not punitive in the sense that they're just meant to punish him for... You were saying that this is meant to change the balance and to give the rebels back, get them back on an even fighting field.
I mean, now Obama's, he is not saying that. But it seems hard to me to separate the two objectives. If you are constraining the weapons that Assad can use, you're restraining his ability to win the war outright. I just don't see how you separate that. And now Obama's got to walk a very fine line rhetorically because he's trying to get the support for the resolution from people who want to keep things limited and the support from the McCain wing saying we have to win this. This has to be part of a broader strategy. So it can be hard to parse through all the rhetoric that Obama has to say to keep those factions in line. But right. I think common sense
if he were talking just to me and he said, what I want to do is to just keep this thing going. I don't want anybody to win. I would be more inclined to support that than what I've heard publicly stated.
But I think that is what it is, but I don't think it's as cynical as that. It's not just we want to have a civil war there for 30 years. We want them to become exhausted with it so we can get back to the table.
I don't think there's, you know, the rebels won't be satisfied with anything short of toppling Assad. And Assad won't be satisfied with anything short of ruling all of Syria. I don't see how there's any chance for negotiation unless, it's a zero-sum game, I believe.
I mean, that may be, and obviously if that's what it is, and what Obama's doing is not going to work. But I think that's the point of disagreement there. Now, your other point, which I think is, I don't think it's fair to say Obama's doing this because of his personal credibility. If nothing else, that if you're lobbing a few missiles just because you blurted something out, you know, several months ago and it didn't work, that's not going to enhance your credibility. So it strikes me as illogical that the politics are that low. If he was concerned about his personal reputation, he could have found a way to walk back that red line comment a long time ago and deprioritize the whole Syria thing and get back on other problems of the world that are far less complicated. I think he has a sincere desire to resolve this situation because he has a foreign policy view that he actually wants to execute. And Syria, you know, is in the way of executing it. But to the tactical question, will limited strikes work? I think that's fairer ground to debate. I think it's a hard ground to debate because, you know, neither you and I are military experts. You know, I did MSNBC.
But Bill, they're also, let me just say, what's really bothering me too about this is the verbal gymnastics, the things that people are telling us that just ain't so. Like the line that the military says that it doesn't matter how long we wait. In fact, the longer we wait could be better. That defies logic. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that. Obviously, Assad can hide and move around weapons. The longer we give him, the greater warning. I don't know where this degrade and whatever line came from. It reminds me of repeal and replace. But that came out yesterday out of nowhere. It just and then Obama's decision, which struck me as really capricious, which was after John Kerry goes and gives us a impassioned case before the American public that this is a moral cause and that this is about American values. And I mean, he had me just ready to march off, you know. Then the next day Obama comes out and starts off giving this really impassioned case about why we simply cannot tolerate this. And then he turns on a dime at the 11th hour and says, well, we're going to send it to Congress, though. But I don't have to. I don't have to send it to Congress. I don't really need their approval. But we're going to. So as Rand Paul said, I mean, it's like theater. And there's a lot of things about Obama's behavior and the way that he's managed this that bother me. You know,
I've seen this criticism from, you know, mainly from conservative quarters, but I think other quarters as well, that that he's being sort of an uncertain and unstable presence, is vacillating, and it seems kind of, you know, policy on the fly, and obviously he's, you know, taking a lot of hits for that. I think that you know, I talked with this with my Woodrow Wilson piece last week. You know, he had a period of about 18 months or so where after the Lusitania was sunk, and he didn't, you know, join the war right away. You know, he got a lot of flack from the Teddy Roosevelt, you know, imperialist Republicans that wanted him to, you know, get on with it, and was criticized for being, timid and weak and, meandering, in that run-up period. But I think you can look back on that period and say, he had an actual belief that going into the war would have a lot of negative consequences, and had a sincere desire to want to avert that and want to try to solve the problem in a different way. And that had the secondary benefit of when he felt that the line was absolutely crossed and there was no choice, he was seen as a credible figure to bring the country into war precisely because he was doing it reluctantly.
Yes, but Bill, I mean, he's telling us that this is urgent and that this is important and that we simply cannot tolerate this, A. B, but we're going to send it to Congress. C, but I don't have to. I don't have to send it to them. I don't have to listen to what they say. I don't know what he's doing. And you know, Bill, I'm the first person to criticize Republicans for doing stupid things and behaving stupidly and for brinkmanship. And they're engaging in, you know, Republicans are engaging in brinkmanship and things that, in comparison, seem pretty trivial to the brinkmanship that Obama engaged in with the red line. And then just capricious, vacillating, whatever, you know, dithering, what, you know, what, whatever you want to call it, it's bizarre behavior, and it doesn't match. It seems dissonant. The rhetoric that this is bear any burden, pay any price, this cannot stand, but we have to send it to Congress. But
well, I mean, I think
we're not
going
to listen to him anyway.
I mean, I think that what's reconcilable there. I mean, yes, there are two, I think, objectives of Obama that don't line up perfectly neatly. I mean, one is that Obama is trying to set a standard that genocide and genocidal tactics are not acceptable. I mean, and this is why, you know, Samantha Power has been such a close ally or a main figure in his foreign policy brain trust. You know, she literally wrote the book on genocide, criticizing America's unwillingness to intervene with Rwanda and Sudan. Obama's action in Libya was an example of Gaddafi is threatening a genocide. We are not going to wait until he actually does it. We have to act to prevent. We have to intervene and make and as quickly as possible.
Is like essentially the Bush doctrine, sort of.
Sort of.
The preemptive strike.
I mean, again, my concern with Bush was that there are ulterior motives there, but yeah, that's why I think there's differences. But the other part of the Obama foreign policy shift, which is the direct reaction from Bush, is that don't act if you can't do it in a credibly effective way. If you only go in when you have the moral standing, but you're by yourself, you know, maybe you have the best intentions, but it's probably not going to work. You're not going to have, there'll be too many questions about your ulterior motives, and then you won't get enough intrinsic support on the ground, and the whole thing's going to blow up in your face. So, he saw the opening to get the UN backing for Libya, and he got it. Here in Syria, he does not see the opening with the UN because of Russia's veto. And he hoped, it seems, that the initial horror of the act would be enough to get intrinsic support elsewhere. And when that wasn't materializing, as shown by the British Parliament vote, he said, okay, I want to do this. I feel I need to do this. It's morally necessary to do this. But it's not going to work until I get this ratified somewheres. And the first step is going to have to be the U.S. Congress. And now there's a suggestion that...
Just
to finish it quickly. Once you get that, perhaps, you can get some additional international support beyond that and have it be much more of a credible operation. So I don't see this as being capricious. I see this as him trying to achieve
these
two
goals. Worse. It's almost worse. You're implying a okay. It's almost worse. You're implying, I don't think you're implying, you're saying that this was calculated and that Obama is using Congress as a pawn. That if he had gotten the international community behind this, he could have flouted the Constitution and he could have acted unilaterally.
As your point, his argument is not that it's constitutionally necessary. He is saying you can have a strike, you can have a limited strike without. I mean, we've had plenty of limited strikes, Reagan, Clinton, that did not go through Congress. So I mean, he is not saying that I was going to flout the Constitution. And now I'm not. He's saying this was not a constitutional question.
So, okay, I think the assumption is. I think the assumption, though, is that he came to the decision that it was appropriate to get the American public behind this and to have our legislative branch, you know, who does still exist, to approve this. And it sounds like you're saying the only reason he felt like he needed to do that is because Britain didn't support him. That if he wouldn't have felt the need to bother to deign to ask Congress to weigh in had other things gone right. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
I think it's probably true.
Okay, that's okay. That's interesting. Though I do want to ask you about, I think we should talk about some petty partisan politics, because I think this certainly impacts it. I do want to know what you think about on the left. I know Hillary has yesterday come out, I guess, in favor of supporting Obama on this. It's interesting on the right, I wrote yesterday at the Daily Caller, I think this really helps Rand Paul, because Rand Paul owns the non-interventionist brand, and there's nothing he can do. He can't try to have it both ways. This is who he is. He gets the benefit of being sort of a part of the libertarian zeitgeist, but he ain't going to fool any defense contractors or AIPAC into giving him money, right? So Rand Paul sort of, he's been fleshed out. We know who he is, and he gets the benefit and the downside of that. Conversely, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, some of his competitors who are in the U.S. Senate, have sort of been able to have it both ways a little bit. When they want to talk non-interventionist, they can. When they want to talk like hawks, they can. This is going to flesh that out a little bit. We're going to get them on the record. And you could argue there's nuance. I mean, Rubio has been saying that he's against... Rubio has been sounding like he's against this strike because we should have acted 2 years earlier when there was a chance where we could have actually supported moderates, and it's too late. So, but you could argue that it's a binary choice, that there's no asterisk on this. You're either for Obama or you're for Assad, as one wag put it. So I think this is good news for Rand Paul, because it's going to force his opponents to sort of take a position, as he has a long time ago. They're not going to be able to have it both ways. What do you think about that? And my guess is on the left, Bill, that this could have longer term, it's nothing immediate, but long term ramifications, you could have Democrats regret later, possibly, depending on how things go, they may regret supporting this intervention.
Well, I take your point, and I kind of partly agree with your piece. Yes, this is, you know, Rand has the consistent view on the subject, and he has no qualms how he's going to vote about it. Other folks who have been trying to straddle these wings of the party, now that the rift between the national security wing and the, or maybe say interventionist and non-interventionist wings, maybe that's the way to characterize it, that would, what doesn't get anyone annoyed.
Go ahead and man up and call us isolationists, Bill.
I mean, I
you know
do.
You want to.
I do, but I know the Paulites get all twitchy about that. We're not isolationists.
Anyway,
we just never want to intervene anywhere. That's totally different. We still want to trade with other countries. We're not isolationists.
Well, they have, I mean, they do have an argument.
That rift is growing, and now here's a vote where you can't straddle that. So I take that point completely. I do think there is the negative consequence for Rand in that I'm not sure it's in his interest or it is his desire to have this subject be the primary issue that he campaigns on going into 2016. I don't think he's. I think he deep down wants to win the argument about non-intervention versus intervention, but I don't know. He thinks that's his main path to victory. They might be better off with talking about debt and civil liberties and big government.
I think Rand is probably better off. You want to play this thing out, right? Rand is probably better off if his opponents vote, if his adversaries vote for intervention in Syria, and because then it's sort of they're on Obama's side.
Well, that's only true if the Syrian operation doesn't work. I mean, that gets back to the calculation. It could
work.
The odds
are it's
not
possible.
Going to work.
There's many ways that it fails.
Sure.
It's hard. Like, even if it nominally succeeds, you can always paint it as a failure. It's going to be very difficult to point to this and say, clearly this was a brilliant move. It clearly worked. It's going to be, like, the scenario where it turns out obvious that this was a great stroke.
Every Democrat who had 2008 ambitions, who were voting in Congress, said, Iraq is going to work. And I don't want to be on the losing side, so I might as well vote for it. And I mean, I'm being a little overly simplistic and overly crude.
But that's also put in the context of decades and decades and decades of Democrats losing because they were perceived as being doves.
That's right. And that proved out not to be the politically wise vote to have taken. You know, you just don't know in a war. You know, a lot of folks thought that Kosovo was never. If you're not putting boots on the ground in Kosovo, how are you going to win a war with just air power? It's impossible. Never going to happen. Well, it worked. You know, sometimes it works. So
yeah, but I don't think if you're a Republican who opposed Kosovo, I don't think that hurt you one bit.
It didn't. I mean, it just sort of faded to the background by 2000 and wasn't a main issue. But I do think it's a little bit different with Paul, because he is putting so much on this vote now.
There's another interesting, not to move off Paul, but Tom Cotton, who is running really the star on the Republican side. You know, 2014 is supposed to be a Republican year in the Senate, you know, a lot of vulnerable Democrats. And yet we've only really seen, you know, one star emerge. You've got Liz Cheney running against Inzi in Wyoming. You've got Bevin running against McConnell. So these are primaries. But in terms of a general, you got Tom Cotton down in Arkansas. He's a congressman. He's running against Mark Pryor. The other three congressmen are against intervention in Syria. Only Tom Cotton, who is a big Bill Kristol fan, only Tom Cotton has come out in favor of this. So the question is, what does Mark Pryor, the incumbent Democrat senator, the embattled senator, do? I say he goes against Syrian intervention now. I think that's the smart play for him in Arkansas. So
I agree. I agree. That's probably the right politics for him, as far as, you know, what do you think is showing independence from Obama? You're probably reflective of the people at the time. If it does work out, you can try to say, you know, I was just expressing my concerns. It was a difficult
and
situation.
Pryor's in such trouble. I don't think he can play it safe. I think he needs to find a way to get to the right of Cotton. And it seems almost a godsend for Pryor that he can now. I mean, the guy, he may be gone anyway. it may not matter. He's in such danger, but this is sort of a lifeline for him, I think.
But to your other question, what does it mean for Democrats generally? I mean, right now you don't see, I don't know of any potential 16er who is making a point of actively organizing to defeat the Syrian resolution.
Where's Howard Dean on this?
I haven't heard Howard Dean on this, actually. I don't. Maybe he's gonna. I don't know where we're reviewing it. I mean, the most vociferous antagonist on the left now is Alan Grayson, I think. And maybe he does harbor 2016 ambitions. I haven't heard that. But he certainly sees a national platform when he can. And he started Don't Attack Syria website. He's had very combative interviews on MSNBC.
I give him credit for being consistent. I mean, I always thought the guy was just a jerk and just a leftist, but, you know, maybe
may be that he's still a jerk. I mean, I don't think
he very well may be.
I mean, if you listen to the interviews he's given,
I assumed he was a hack, though. Hack. The guy.
I might argue he still is a hack, because when you hear his interviews, you don't actually hear a coherent argument for being against it. You hear him just grabbing every possible argument one might have and shoving it together, regardless of whether it all adds up into anything sensible. You know, he said, on the Thomas Roberts show yesterday, he said, you know, that this is his main mantra, it's not our responsibility, which is basically an isolationist argument. And look, that's not illegitimate to be an isolationist or a pacifist, for that matter. I mean, that you can have a consistent, you know, legitimate view in that regard. But then the next breath, Grayson says, why aren't we doing anything for the Syrian refugees? Well, guess what, buddy? That's saying that someone else out in the world is your responsibility. You know, either you're responsible or you're not. I think he's just kind of grabbing at random arguments to make a play for himself. And so I don't consider what he's doing to be I think you can be honorably against the Syrian resolution. There are plenty of tactical reasons to be concerned. There's plenty of philosophical reasons to believe that a military strike always results in blowback. I don't think you're not a patriot or you're a bad person if you believe that. But I do have a problem with slipshod arguments that speak to a more irrational reason for your position, not a rational one.
So let me challenge you a little bit, Bill, to be introspective. I'm sure you've done this already. Are you sure deep down that you're not supporting this because you like Obama? If this was Bush, same exact scenario, or if John McCain were president, God help us, or Mitt Romney. Do that history. We'd have bombed Syria a long time ago. Maybe it would have been better. But no, I mean, if there were a Republican president and they were behaving exactly the same way that Obama has, and Republicans were saying the same things that John Kerry and Menendez are saying, would you still be for this?
Well, again, I have a belief in Obama's foreign policy. You know, it's not just that he is Obama and there's a D next to his name. I think he has taken several actions in the past 5 years that reinforce my hope in his foreign policy going into 2008, that make me feel like, yes, he has a very distinct vision that I think is very important to see realized. I think that that's true in his way he's not rushed to war with Iran, the way he supported a revolution in Libya, and the way he supported revolution in Egypt. I think all those decisions reinforced my belief going in. And so I'm not going to separate out how he acted there and cut and paste what Bush did in Iraq and imposed on Obama in Syria. Like, I can't remove the other actions he's taken. I have to look at the Syria choices in context with the other one and say, how does this all add up? If I thought that Obama was somehow junking what he did in the past and
glomming, so you bought into you're like the guy, you bought into the system. You know, it's like the Redskins do the option, and you're a believer in that. You bought into the Obama brand, like sort of the system, the foreign policy system.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you're not judging this specifically on its merits of this individual case. You trust him based on a track record of, you know, 5 years of doing the right thing for foreign policy.
I think it's basically correct. I feel I have a limitation as a non-military expert, as I think 99.99% of Americans are not. I understand that tactically this could not work. I'm not out there saying I know it's going to work. This is going to be a cakewalk. I'm not saying that. It could well not work. But by the same token, I think it's not correct to say I know it's not going to work. You know, and I was on.
I appreciate your disclaimer that you're not a military expert. Neither am I. But you know what? I said this earlier, and I'm going to repeat it. I don't trust the military people, what they tell us. I do not think we should. I mean, I think
they're telling us different things. I mean, I'm hearing lots of different stuff from military experts these days. I don't see a consistent pattern.
But I'm just saying, I think it's we have a civilian-led, you know, commander-in-chief for a reason, and whether you're, I don't like the chicken hawk arguments, because you didn't serve, you can't be for a war. But I don't like the other argument either, because you're not a military expert, you can't be against it. I mean, to me, Tom Cotton in Arkansas is, you know, going to run on, you know, a very honorable and accomplished military record. I mean, it's part of your resume. It's important, but, you know, it's like, Ron Jaworski, you know, I got football in the brain, by the way, Bill. It's that time of year. You know, I wrote this piece called Jaws versus the Monkey a couple years ago. And Ron Jaworski is, you know, former Eagles quarterback. And he watches, you know, he's an ESPN analyst, and he watches like hours and hours and hours of game footage every week. And he's a former quarterback too. And he goes on Tony Kornheiser's radio show, and they do a segment called Jaws versus the Monkey, because Ron Jaworski's nickname is Jaws. And the monkey, every week they pick games, and the monkey is supposedly some, I mean, I think, I don't know if it's like them flipping the coin or Tony Kornheiser is the monkey. I don't know if it's like just random, but the monkey beats Ron Jaworski every year in terms of picking football games. And I think that, you know, expertise is important, and certainly respect people who've served and who've accomplished a great deal. But when it comes to deciding whether or not to put lives on the line, I take their opinion and I take it for what it's worth. But I do not. I think it's a danger to put too much trust in the so-called experts. And by the way, now Karl Rove also qualifies, as you may know, as a foreign policy expert. So that applies to him as well.
No, I'm not arguing that you're not allowed to have an opinion if not a military expert. Americans, it's a democracy, and we should decide our foreign policy direction. I think it's hard.
I could talk about abortion too. I'm not a woman. Right. You know, I mean, I feel like I could talk about anything. You don't have to be somebody involved, you know? You don't have to live on the border to have a position on immigration reform, despite what some people think.
I agree with all of that. And I think that I hear from military experts, I hear not one school of thought. So I was on MSNBC on Sunday. I was up against Jack Jacobs, a military expert. He seemed to be very much against this, and I respect his view. And he knows more about the military than I do, but I could very easily find other military experts that say something different. So I guess got to take their opinion and put it into the mix of how I come out where I am. And I, what I come out with is I'm not going to make my final call based on the tactical debate, because I don't think I don't know enough about the tactics to weigh in that. All I can weigh in on is what I think is the right objective, and put some trust in people who share my objective that they know how to get there.
All I'm saying is, and I agree with all that, I think we've been too deferential as a people, and I think we've been too enamored by experts a little bit. So I'm putting an end to that.
All right, I know you got
to
run.
That's all I have to say about this.
you have to run, correct?
I do have to run, Bill. Always a pleasure talking to you.
You too.
Always a pleasure.
I think we've maintained civil debate in a time of imminent war.
Well, that's what you come to. You know, it's times like these that the American public needs the DMZ more than ever. So I'm glad that we could serve, you know, in this capacity. So I don't want to be like the Romney boys who served their country, you know, on the campaign. But we are here doing our part, albeit very small, but, you know, we're doing our thing.
We're keeping the Republic together.
We're back. Bill, who do you like? I know that you're into this soccer, right?
No, I'm an Aussie
Australian
rules. I'm Aussie rules football. Not a soccer man.
Who do you like? Are you a Patriots fan, though? I mean, you're up
no,
there.
And... No, I was born in New York. I can't root for Boston teams.
Giants?
I was for Giants and Jets. I didn't pick sides in New York.
Okay. Well, as you know, I'm a Redskins fan, and it's the era of unbridled optimism. RG3 back. Something about him makes me feel like it's a Greek tragedy waiting to happen. But we'll see. Hopefully, I'm wrong, and hopefully, he kicks butt. So
on the Aussie rules side, my North Melbourne Kangaroos didn't make it in the last week, but there's actually a big story there. The Essendon Bombers, who are playoff bound, last week of the regular season, the league kicked them out of the playoffs for doping. The entire team was kicked
out of the
playoffs.
Well, you know, we're doping here. I mean, you don't get to this level of performance without some aid. So, I mean, it's just coffee, caffeine, but
they opened up a playoff slot for the last week of the season, and the few teams had to fight out. My Kangaroos had a shot, but they came up short.
We should do a whole show. I think the public's clamoring for us to do a whole show about sports. We could do the over under on the Aussie Kangaroos and whatnot. Well, a very special DMZ.
Well, I don't want to keep you. I don't want to make you run late.
All right, man. See you later.
Take care.